Hey there, everyone. This is Chris Larson, Associate Editor for Behavioral Health Business. Welcome to our latest edition of the BHB Perspectives podcast. I'm experimenting a bit with this one. For this edition, I assembled a panel of experts to explore the business case for gambling addiction treatment. If you have even a passing interest in sports, you've likely been inundated with ads from digital gambling platforms encouraging you to add a thrill to your sports viewing experience. On top of that, the rise of digital equities trading and similar platforms that effectively allow users to gamble on everything from the weather to the outcomes of electoral races means that we have never seen such easy access to gambling and such an elevated risk to problematic gambling behaviors. In this conversation, we lay out the business aspect of this treatment niche, where it's been in recent years, and where it's going. In this episode, you will hear from Rebecca Schechter, Senior Advisor at McKinsey & Company, Andrew DiGiacomo, Senior Vice President of Strategy for Birch's Health, and Yusuf Khalad, Principal at Alicorp. Okay, let's get into it. Thank you, everyone, for being here today. We're going to go ahead and get started with introductions so the listeners can hear your names and titles. And since this is an audio-only podcast, pair your voice with your name. Rebecca, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Well, thank you for having me. Really pleased to be part of the conversation today. My name is Rebecca Schechter. I am the former CEO of Optum Behavioral Health, which is one of the larger payers here in North America, and had the privilege of pivoting what was a payer into digital and into care delivery. I currently serve as an advisor to the Onos team and looking forward to the conversation.
And Andrew, can you introduce yourself, please?
Hey, everyone. Andrew DiGiacomo. So I'm the Senior Vice President for Strategy here at Birch's Health, mainly concentrating on network strategy, our payer strategy, and our overall relationships here at Birch's. Been here just about a month, and before that was leading the behavioral network at Cigna Evernorth.
Awesome. And Yusuf, could you please introduce yourself?
Sure, and grateful to be on the podcast with you all. So I'm Yusuf Khalad. I'm a principal investor at Alicorp. We are one of New York's oldest and probably most active early stage venture fund. We invest across verticals and categories, and I specifically focus on investing in companies like Birch's Health that are of consequence to families, to individuals, with a focus on improving how people learn, earn, and access critical care.
Thank you guys so much for being here. So I want to start off by helping listeners understand this very specific subsector of behavioral health as it exists today. I'll be asking each of you to share some foundational insights that will give us a solid footing for the conversation as we go forward. Andrew, I want to start with you. So from the perspective of a leader at a treatment organization, that being Birch's, what are the most defining features of the world of gambling addiction treatment?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think first off, for me, it's how far behind the treatment infrastructure is starting to fall behind, because as everybody knows, as we head into Super Bowl weekend, the speed that sports betting, online gambling has just expedited is unbelievable. You now have 39 states and DC that have legalized sports betting. And one of the wildest numbers that we're starting to see is 28% of adults are starting to gamble daily online. And then very similar to what we saw probably about 4 or 5 years ago coming out of COVID, there's a shortage of clinicians that are specialized in this. 4 or 5 years ago, it was general mental health access. And now we're starting to look at the specialties and saying, you know, gambling is starting to become a larger and larger problem. The other defining feature is that unlike substance use disorders, where, you know, gambling disorder doesn't require detox or management for the most part, and which means the clinical model is looking differently, a little bit of the Wild West. And that's where I get so excited about Birch's, is we're taking this step forward to not only grow the population of providers, but also dive into the clinical models and the clinical path to serve the United States as we can.
Right. And the role of third-party payers in healthcare generally cannot be understated in any segment of any part of healthcare. Now, Rebecca, given part of your background includes working on the payer side of things, what can you tell us about how payers have approached gambling addiction treatment in the past?
So I actually would take a step back relative to your question and say, in general, how do payers look at specialized solutions? And maybe even before answering the question, I have to say, I have to echo Andrew's sentiment and actually double click one level deeper. I happen to be the parent of a middle schooler. And what I found out, the highest growth behavior that schools are worried about for middle schoolers here in Massachusetts, where we unfortunately have legalized a whole bunch of gambling, is gambling. We're talking middle schoolers. And so if you put yourself now back in the shoes of a payer and trying to get ahead of emerging trend, I look at this as something that is going to emerge with a whole new generation of folks that, be it social media, gambling, et cetera, are creating a whole new set of needs that the current environment is not quite geared to serve. So as a payer, when I would get approached by specialized solutions, I actually would put it through four filters, if you want. The first and always my first and foremost was the clinical model. And I think, Andrew, you brought it up very early on. Having a valid clinical model is critical because you want to make sure that this is not just a solution that, you know, doesn't actually deliver what it's promising to do. The second is, do they actually measure clinical outcomes, and how does it compare to alternatives? And I know we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what Burgess is doing, but having the ability to show that you are driving care through measurement-based methodology and that you can show improvement relative to alternatives is key. The third is, how does it impact affordability / cost of care, particularly in the environment right now where a lot of payers are looking at difficult trends that they hadn't anticipated? How does this actually help them stretch every dollar that they're investing in helping members get to care to the maximum amount? And then lastly, is this a solution that if I lean into, I actually can see will scale? Be it, is there a platform that they rely on? Do they have a better way of recruiting and retaining providers? I do think that ends up being pretty critical, particularly if you're talking about national plans that are looking for solutions that they can pitch to employers and government agencies at scale. So when I as a payer took a step back and I put every solution through those four filters, you know, if I ended up having a positive answer and it solved a key capability in the gaps that I had or that I started to see, if it allowed me to differentiate myself and it gave me the ability to more effectively support members, it ended up being a very easy decision to bring that forward. So I'm hoping that helps just give a little color and texture to how a payer thinks about a specialty solution.
It definitely does. And we have the additional privilege of, Andrew, your background, most recently before Burgess, included your work in also on that side of things in the payer space. Is there anything else that you would add before we move on?
Yeah, I think Rebecca nailed it. The only things I would add on top of it was that when we talk about the utilization issues that payers are dealing with, it was a very good thing in the past 4 to 5 years after COVID. We needed access. We know that. Now we're getting to better access. I wouldn't say we're there yet, but then to echo measurement-based outcomes and finding ways to get the right person to the right provider at the right time, that's where the specialty solutions, I think, over the next year or two are going to really come to the forefront, because as we see an increased investment in things like the proper matching algorithm from our payer friends, then we will see these opportunities for places like Burgess to say, hey, there wasn't a big concentration on gambling addiction in the past. It was kind of something that once it got severe, maybe you would mention it to a PCP and maybe they'd get you to a provider with experience. What we're going to see in the future is, hey, let's find places where we're meeting the patient where they are and getting them into a total cost of care value for the payer. Because Rebecca hit that too. Total cost of care is huge. We know that at the end of the day, the payers look at finances as the number one thing, along with taking care of your patient. And if we as providers can't meet that, we're not going to be at the forefront of what we need to do.
There's one other thought that I don't think we touched on, and I mentioned it briefly, and I think, Andrew, you kind of touched on it, is as a payer, having a validated, clinically driven, measurement-based solution for specialty actually is differentiating for me.
Absolutely.
Particularly if I am pitching to folks, i.e., let's say employers to start off with, that might be seeing an emerging trend and want to get ahead of it. And so as a payer, my ability to say, listen, I actually have a ready-made solution here. I have a way to navigate people into it. And by the way, I actually think it works and it lowers cost, ends up being a good thing for me as a payer, as I'm trying to differentiate myself against other competitors in the marketplace. So it might be a second order effect, but if you think about some of these specialty solutions and the ability to get ahead of trend, it ends up being easier for me to I pitch myself to a state that's delegating their Medicaid risk to me, or to through a broker to an employer. It ends up also being a way for me to drive my growth, right? Not just manage the spend.
Yes.
All right. Absolutely. Now, we're going to get to a lot of those points in much more detail, but before we do that, Yusuf, I want to turn to you and get your perspective. So your firm has invested in Birches Health. From the perspective of capital, why is this industry something that warrants a place to, you know, place this kind of money?
Sure. So I think I'd love to start with kind of our mandate and then talk about the why now. I think from a mandate perspective, how we think about investing, and in particular my team at Alicorp, is investing in companies rethinking economic infrastructure for families, for individuals. So we've spent a lot of time in health and in care. We've spent a lot of time on the clinical workforce. The area that I think I've been obsessed with over the last 4 or so years is this question of individual sort of despair. Some have called it male despair, and also this disintegration in families. So I spent a lot of time looking at solutions in universities and colleges and education and workforce. The thing that consistently popped up was the link between despair at the individual level and despair within communities and within families, and the prevalence of the sort of gamblerization or the financialization of so many things in society and the impact it has on people. And so that was, I think, a very clear sort of mandate fit. I think the why now has been obvious to me for some time. We've been legalizing online sports betting for, at this point, close to a decade. You know, it used to be that you imagine a gambler and there's someone at a slot machine. And increasingly, to Rebecca's point, young people in my life, including young family members, usually male, you know, are using this stuff. And sometimes it's for entertainment. Other times it's, frankly, out of desperation or need. And it moved from simply sports to much broader financial speculation. So the why now is fairly clear. There was a social trend and a technological trend that we're meeting. I think the final question was around, okay, what is unique about a potentially a behavioral health solution in an age when we have really large scaled up solutions? And so it was, I think, obvious from, you know, listening to sessions of folks who were meeting in sort of church basements and community centers, you know, talking with people like Elliot about the experience of folks that he's known in his life, and looking at the very specific impact of gambling disorder on people, it was obvious that you couldn't just treat it through a typical traditional behavioral health platform, right? This population, number one, is suffering from not just mental distress, but financial and social and familial distress, and it has very unique impacts on them. That's the first. Number two, you have to sort of meet them in new and unique and interesting ways. And so Birches being able to distribute both direct to consumer and through payers, but also through, at this stage, more than a dozen different state agencies and governments that people reach out to when they're in distress, right? Calling their hotlines, I think, was really critical. And the final piece to both Rebecca and Andrew's point was, well, is there evidence that this actually moves the needle both on the immediate sort of behavioral challenges that people are experiencing, but also beyond that, right? How does it impact their family relationships, their marriages, their livelihoods? And it's fairly clear that there's a real outcome for folks. So from our vantage point, right place, right time, technological and social change happening at once, and a very clear business case for why you needed a differentiated specialty model here relative to potentially more generic behavioral health platforms.
Right. And one of the things I want to establish at the beginning are what other signals that we've highlighted many, but if there are any that we need to add to the conversation early on, we need to do that now. But what else is out there that proves that there's a sustainable business case for gambling addiction treatment that, you know, that we haven't highlighted so far? And I will note, you know, the reason that, as Andrew highlighted, the collective systems are behind on this is because of economic challenges that would disincentivize investment in this space. So what other signals show that there is a sustainable business case here?
Yeah, I'll jump in really quickly first. I think over the past 10 years, it's grown into where we are now. And what always comes with that is once the insurance coverage gets there, right, the expansion of recognizing the DSM code so that we can build to it, that's how the market continues to grow. We're now in network with over 100 plans across all 50 states, right? That's a big step, because now you're talking about when the payers can now go talk to the employer plans. When we do, we can say we can cover them nationwide. And what the other part, and I think we're going to keep hitting on this today, is total cost of care, right? Like, in the past, we had a very reactive approach. What we are going forward with is a proactive approach of getting out in front of these people, getting them to care quickly, and then making sure we get them to stabilization before they get to a level that's much more costly within the healthcare ecosystem, right? ER visits or an inpatient stay, and at the worst level, moving into suicidality, those costs are significant. And I think that recognition that getting people to the right provider earlier, especially in gambling, reduces that significantly. So that investment, we're seeing that a lot with a lot of the payers saying specialized treatment gets us on that, helps us on the back end for total cost of care. And then compound that with what Youssef was saying and Rebecca has been saying as well, is the amount of ads out there are just skyrocketing for gambling. So the market is kind of building itself, and we're kind of lucky to get on the forefront of that for now.
All right, Youssef, what do you think?
So just to add to Andrew's point, I think there are two other critical trends to sort of look at. I think the first is Birch's Health has been around for only a couple of years, but we've had daily sort of fantasy or sports betting in some way, shape, or form for, at this stage, a decade and a half. We've had now the emergence of prediction markets for half a decade, if not a little bit longer. And so what I am imagining for a platform like Birch's Health is that it's very much trailing the growth, the prevalence, the popularity of these platforms, probably by 5 to 10 years. And of course, with the work that Andrew and others at Birch's are doing, bringing on greater clinicians and expanding care, maybe narrows the gap of how quickly you sort of catch up to the need. But I don't think that we've fully understood the depth of the need and the problem when we consider how long these other platforms have been around for. The other very quick point I'll share is, you know, estimates for problem gambling around the country range from, call it 2.5 to 5 million adults. And we by no means serve 5 million adults, a month today. And so until we get to that point, I think there's going to be tremendous need and tremendous runway for a platform like Birch's.
And Rebecca, what other signals should we highlight here?
So there are two other things that I would point to that payers care about, and particularly their customers care about. The first is, this is one of these interesting intersections of health and wealth, where you end up having, and I think Andrew, you mentioned it, you have financial stressors, mental stressors, this is one of these situations where a lot of, let's say, an employer's incentives are aligned to actually figure out how to help folks because they know the incredible toll that this is taking. And this is something that people will be taking very seriously because it actually extends to more than one dimension. And I do think that's another strong signal of something that people are going to pay attention to. Piling onto Youssef's point around, we haven't even gotten to the edge of how this is manifesting. I actually think of the extensions to this treatment model that will apply to other forms of what I would call digital type addiction. Could it be social media? Could it be like there are a whole host of things that back to that middle schooler usage that I see us slowly but surely see emerging that we're going to have to help treat. And I actually think Birch's puts themselves in a very good position as they focus initially on gambling. But I do think they have the opportunity to actually extend the model beyond that with what I would consider to be clinical and then what I would call subclinical capabilities wrapped in a digital platform that ends up being a powerful engine. So those are the other signals I would mention.
Okay. And Rebecca, I want you to get the first word on this next question that I want to explore. And it's a question of specializing in providing point solutions versus more encompassing offerings, right? So right now, is the case more that there needs to be this kind of standalone specialist in the field, or should this eventually be something that needs to be offering other more encompassing services like you were hinting at, Rebecca, or exist within a larger behavioral health context? I remember back in 2020 and 2020 through 2022, especially, there was that huge glut of venture capital into all kinds of digital health solutions. And it didn't take very long for us to start talking to people on the enterprise and the health plan side saying that we're feeling some point solution fatigue here. So Rebecca, from your perspective, like, what is the right approach now? Is it more point solutions and hyper specialty, or is it broad and encompassing?
So I would say that the pendulum has swung in a couple of, to your point, it initially swung to what I would call death by point solution. And people, employers in particular, were getting bombarded and didn't quite know which way to turn. And frankly, it made it hard for their employees and or the members of the plan to actually even figure out which one of these to use. I do think the pendulum is swinging back to how do we actually, I don't think the answer is have a single solution, because we've also learned the other part of the tug of war is behavioral is a wide spectrum of diagnoses, and you actually might need specialized solutions for different types of diagnoses. So, you know, what you would do for gambling addiction is fundamentally different than what you would do for eating disorders, right? Yet they happen to all be in the same family. And so I think the trick is, in particular, how do you actually help? And I think, Andrew, you mentioned, how do you help get the patient and or the member to the right solution at the right time? And how do you help them navigate to get there? Is it because you're part of, let's say, a benefits solution inside an employer that you actually have a way to get to that? Is it because we have a way to have a better referral network through the clinical channels? Or is it because we actually can reach you digitally more effectively? Like, that to me is the answer, in that in many respects, yes, it is a clinically driven model that is specific and bespoke. And can it extend to other conditions that are appropriate? Yes. More importantly, how do you actually get the member to reach into it? You know, could Birch's be part of some of the more generic roll-ups? I guess, right? That's a little speculative. The more important thing is it is fundamentally different than your average talk therapy. Like, it is just because a gambling disorder is just a different condition, if that makes sense. So there's a little bit of a tug of war there in terms of doing it. To me, the real discussion is, how do you navigate people to the right solution?
Yeah, just to jump in on top of that, I totally agree. I think, Chris, to your point, yes, over the past 4 or 5 years, we saw just a sudden emergence of what I would say generalized talk therapy, right? There was a great growth there. I think as we look towards the next 12, 24, 36 months, the demand will now go to where exactly Rebecca was saying, which is, okay, we will never have too many providers. We know that won't happen in this country, but we will need to have the providers in the right place. And where we can find that opportunity is leveraging the aggregators, right? So making sure that they're looking at their networks and saying, how can we partner with groups like Birch's to ensure people in every space that need a more specified group of care, they get to a company like Birch's and others in some of those other spaces that we talk about all the time. And I think the more that happens, not only the payer is going to be happier, but we have to remember the employer plans, right? You don't hear from a complaint from an employer plan. It's the 80-20 rule, probably even less, right? Like the 98-2% rule, where that one or two people who just can't find the right provider for their child or for themselves, and they feel like there's so many things to choose from. This is where payers are going to jump onto this and say, oh, wait, like for that one situation that can avoid that complaint and really be a delighter to these groups is going to be huge for the payers to take a company like Birch's or an eating disorder company like Equip and others and say, here you go, let's direct you right to them when we need to.
And Yusuf, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree with what was shared. The other thing that I'll sort of posit, and maybe it's slightly controversial, but you know, if we believe that gambling disorder is sort of an emerging public health crisis, then I think we have to believe that gambling disorder is also the tip of the spear for accessing care to a whole host of other things, but it is highly, highly acute. If you've gotten to the point where you need this care, it's likely there's a co-occurrence of very severe, in many cases, substance use disorder, potentially alcohol abuse, digital addiction. And so I actually would argue that having Birches as part of potentially your bundle of offerings allows for getting people into care for a whole host of other things because it's the most acute, the tip of the spear. And so I think that that's what's exciting about the possibility of having people come to the platform is that, you know, it can be sort of the central hub, the referral engine for so many other challenges and issues that people need because they've sought treatment for digital addiction and gambling disorder. The final thing that I'll share, by the way, is that we haven't even scratched the surface yet on the need for sort of one-on-one continuous digital companionship that people need. So just to give a very quick example, there was one day where I ordered a car on my rideshare app, and before I could see where the car was, I had an ad for a gambling site. I was listening to my favorite sports podcast while on the ride, and in the middle of the podcast, I got three gambling ads. I then got off, got into work, checked my email, my favorite newsletter at the very, very end had an ad for one of the sort of same platforms. And so this idea that having this as part of a bundle will be super, super important, but also having that digital companionship, you know, through the platform will be essential for helping people manage these, you know, these triggers in a way that we've probably not needed before, you know, for similar conditions.
Right. And this is a great jumping off point to talk about the interplay that exists necessarily with the systems and the entities that have a hand in people's problematic behaviors and the role that care providers have in trying to help people in need. So I see announcements come across my desk periodically of any number of types of providers that are working in and around the gambling addiction treatment space, partnering with these platforms. Now, this kind of engagement can be potentially very ethically and morally fraught and concerning. Is there a right way to engage with these platforms and how?
So I could jump in really quickly on this. I think I used to work in state government and have worked on sort of bills and regulatory matters. I think whether you're a state government or some sort of prediction market or other platform that might, you know, create marketplaces for this stuff, it is a moral imperative for you to ensure that you create a menu of offerings of support for your customers and users. And so I applaud every single state government that's paved the way for people to sort of access services through their hotline. Similarly, I think it's important and useful that the commercial platforms that are out there, you know, the prediction markets and on, are making these services available, you know, in-app, via email, et cetera, because I think it's a moral responsibility for all of these parties to do that. And I think one of the things I've been really impressed by with Birches, with their leadership, et cetera, is that they evaluate these partnerships on their merits. And the goal of any sort of partnership is not financial gain. It's to ensure that the people who need care see it in the most convenient and easily accessible way possible. And so that's the type of thoughtfulness that I think any sort of entity, whichever side they're on in the market, needs to sort of bring to this.
Yeah, Chris, I'll add on to Yusuf's point, right? Because one of the reasons I joined Birches is because our core mission is to ensure people who need care can find it. So some of these operators can list us as a treatment resource so that when someone recognizes they need help, the access is immediate. It's there. It's virtual. We meet these people where they are. That is the real value here. It's not done in secret. It's out in the open that they can get the care if they go to a point that they need it. And to be really clear, and I think this is an important thing, and Yusuf, you kind of alluded to it, but we have never been paid by a gambling company for any kind of these treatment services. We just want to be, to Yusuf's point, out there in front of it in case someone needs that help. And that's kind of our core mission as well, as we made sure that we could get out to get insurance and state funding. And that separation is what we can make sure to keep that as a clean relationship, so we never muddy those waters there. So I think that's really important to your point, Chris. Like, we don't know what's going to happen in 6, 12, 18 months, state by state, and the determinations they make with these things. So that's why we concentrate on the clinical care and being available for people who need it.
The only other color I would add is I also think Birches is in a unique position to work with payers to help educate some of the regulators and state agencies. I reminisce back to when parity was, there was quite a bit of complexity that happened out of COVID. And as a large payer, I actually went out of my way to work with some of the state leadership to help them understand this is what this means. This is what it is and isn't. And I do think, given how emerging these conditions are, given the unbelievably destructive aspects, as I said, across health and wealth, there is an opportunity to educate those stakeholders, be they in government, in regulatory agencies, in industry associations, that you can actually help move the knowledge forward to point people to the clinically driven, medically measurement-based solutions and the likes of Birches. There is a unique opportunity to do that as well.
Understood. Now, Yusuf, I want you to get the first word on our next question. We're going to lean on your background in working in state government. So if we're trying to understand the business case for gambling addiction treatment, what role do local, state, federal governments play in this market? And generally, do you see them as enabling or hindering the slice of healthcare right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think local government, state, federal, in some cases diverge tremendously. So, I don't want this to be sort of a blanket statement. I think at the local and state level, the greatest role that government can play is to continue to make sort of funding available to the extent possible for members of the population that might not be covered, that might not know where care is available, and that in fact might need support for their first few sessions. But more than that, actually, I think the greatest role they can play is to be a distribution engine for care, because they're a trusted third party, because they are sort of the entity that very much has the public health responsibility on their hands. In particular, if they've legalized sports betting, they usually have an office of gaming that's in charge of ensuring that folks get access to care. I think at the federal level, we're still waiting to frankly see the type of urgency and support that maybe other public health crises have received before. And so, in our minds, it's support for research and ensuring that we have a better sense of how this really impacts people. To Rebecca's point a few minutes ago, young people who are just getting started on these platforms at 12, 13, 15 years old. And then number two, funding for care. Those are, I think, the two most critical areas where the federal government could be super supportive.
So I want to talk about the digitalness of a lot of the treatment options, right? So Birches is kind of the case study right now in this conversation, but there are many other providers that are seeking to do this on their own digital platforms. But what I want to hear from you guys is why this is the right way to do it. We've already touched on the convenience and meeting people where they are element. We can dig down deeper into that concept. But the proliferation of the internet literally everywhere, the proliferation of personal devices has made it such that you can gamble anywhere you have the internet. So why is putting treatment in the same place and in the same setting that might be enabling people's worst tendencies the right way to go about this?
Can I jump in first?
Yes.
So you can tell I have a strong opinion on this one. So interestingly, I hate to go back to COVID, but pre-COVID, the percent of behavioral care delivered digitally was in the single percentage digits. I mean, physical health, behavioral, it was like, post-COVID and during COVID, behavioral and physical health exploded, but behavioral remained high. And what we learned was that in some cases, doing things digitally for behavioral was actually more effective than doing it in person. And we did this from a clinical perspective. So I think the first part of the answer is, listen, we've learned a lot about the modality of giving care through COVID that I think has opened our mind up to, listen, it doesn't all have to be face-to-face. So that would be point number one. And I do think particularly for behavioral, very different from physical health, where you actually need to draw blood or whatever it might be, like it has maintained that across different conditions. And coupled with digital capabilities, that be it everything from the ability to text or chat, like there are ways that actually support patients that have been super helpful or in various conditions. So point number two is, listen, not only is it tele and the ability to do things virtually, but it's also other aspects of it, be it texting or otherwise, that have now supplemented the way to treat folks. And then the last point being is there is no better time to treat in general than in the environment that you're in. And I'll let Andrew and team talk about what happens in gambling, but this applies to other things. Like we had examples when at behavioral where, you know, OCD, listen, it is better to see a person in their environment and understand their triggers than to have them in an artificial environment where it actually might not apply. And so I do think, I don't want to take your thunder away, Andrew, but I do think a very similar thing applies here. You're right. It is that is where the gambling is happening, is on their phones or on their computers. That might be exactly the right place to help people as they're being triggered. So Andrew, I'll let you go ahead.
Yeah. What I would tap on to that is, while we get worried about problematic behavior because it's with the internet access, it's on their phone, the reality is the largest contingent of people starting to get addicted to gambling are not going to go to our old traditional treatment sources, which is, and Elliot, our CEO, says this all the time, I'm going to steal his line, you know, the GA meeting in the basement of a church. They're just not going to go. And so you have to balance what the reality of getting the treatment to the member, and then also dealing with the fact that, yes, virtual is here to stay. There is some addictive properties to it, but if they're seeing their provider and the value they're driving from actually keeping therapeutic alliance and adherence to their care far outweighs anything else from that other side.
Right. And Yusuf, anything to add?
No, I mean, the only thing that I'd say is on the clinician front, we continue to see a significant shortage of specially trained clinicians in behavioral, in particular in treating gambling disorder. And so, you know, virtual and the tools that come with virtual just dramatically expand a clinician's ability to serve as many patients as possible. And so I think that's another sort of under-discussed aspect of treating folks through this modality versus maybe a more traditional one.
And understanding, again, the business case, which is what we're here for, understanding the business case of gambling addiction treatment understands how services get paid for, right? When people finally seek help, it's usually because they got a problem. This might mean that they're in a really dire strait, financially speaking. So then how do you build a profitable business that takes care of a population that might have lost its financial stability?
Yeah, I'll jump on here first because the payer side and then Rebecca, I'm sure. But on our side, the most important part is that, you know, the vast majority of our patients, 94%, actually pay less than $25 out of pocket per session. And that's why we continue to push on insurance coverage and getting in network with as many payers as possible, because that is the value there, right? Like avoiding out of pocket, avoiding having to go to cash pay, we believe that's going to lead to more and more people being willing to get to care. The financial barrier to care is largely removed because what we've done to work to get a network, the patient doesn't need to have those resources. They need to have that coverage, and most do. And that's really valuable. And then as we continue to work with state-funded plans, even if they don't have insurance or they don't have a means, if they're covered in a state with some of those taxes that are coming off to fund, and hopefully as those grow, we will continue to work with those states to get that care to those people.
Okay. And Andrew, I want a quick follow-up. So you mentioned those taxes. What are you making reference to there? I think I know what you mean, but let's lay that out for the listener.
Yep. So a portion of, so when you make a bet online, a portion of that is always taxed and it goes to a state funded pool to support mental health resources, things like that. And it, there's specific programs that we align with certain states and we continue to grow to be able to tap into that for people in need as a program.
Thank you for the clarification. Now, Rebecca, I do want to go to you for the next words here.
So I go back to, remember I mentioned those four filters and scalability, and how do you actually partner with providers that you believe have the ability to build a scalable and profitable business for them, but also a way that actually solves your problem. We do look as payers in terms of how are you able to retain and engage the providers? I mean, Youssef mentioned this. There's a shortage of providers. How are you, what is their level of satisfaction as they serve patients on your platform? And then what is the retention you have of the patients that you take in the door? How many of them actually make it through treatment and ultimately end up better off? And so as we look at, as payers, you look at the partners you want to work with, those are the kinds of things you're looking for, and have me particularly excited about Virtus, given their experience to date with clinicians in individual and group sessions, with their experience with patients and their ability to retain people on the platform, attract and then retain them on the platform to get them through care.
And Youssef, any thoughts on this?
No, I would agree with what was shared. The other thing that I would emphasize is that, you know, given the shortage of clinicians and sort of the fierce competition across platforms for, you know, having really strong behavioral health providers, you know, Birches actually has a fairly unique value proposition for providers. So, you know, number one, specialty sort of training and certification in many places. Number two, a super sort of reliable, you know, patient base that, you know, you can see and that you can work on the very same issues over time versus sort of one-off disorders. And then I think the third, a lot of tooling and support to be able to grow your practice, right, as a clinician. And so in this world where there's just such competition across different platforms, I as a clinician, and I validated this in talking with clinicians, would really like to work on a single platform that again has those, delivers those dimensions for me. That's a recipe from a platform perspective that makes for a really profitable kind of sustainable business.
Okay, great. Those are great points. One more thing, sorry, Dr. Chris.
Go ahead.
One other thing, and you know, playing the role of the representative of the payer, is the other thing I would be super excited to talk about is, what does Birches do around that total cost of care? What are they willing to do? Are they willing to put skin in the game that actually is in the form of a bundled payment or an upside downside that actually aligns their incentives, because they know that the treatment model is better than what else is out there, that we get people to feel better, you know, be able to engage in more productive ways faster. That ends up being also an incredible unlock for scalability and aligned incentives across both payer and provider, in this case, payer and Birches. So I do think that innovative and willingness to look at how do you align incentives and alternate payment models has also been a factor for success here.
Right. Rebecca, you're saying a lot of stuff that, you know, we at BHB hear a lot, especially at our live event Value, which is all about payment innovation, Andrew. I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about. You've participated and attended those events in the past. Is there anything that you want to add about, you know, payment innovation when it comes to the work that Birches is doing? And then, you know, even if it's not specific to Birches, the more global idea of trying to pay for care in this specific setting?
I do think in general, behavioral is way behind physical health when it comes to alternate payment models and any form of this. And having led one of the largest payers in the system, I will tell you, sadly, a lot of this is not for lack of will to do it. A lot of it has to do with the complexity of the underlying systems, that it turns out when I was running the largest payer, we couldn't figure out a way to actually make it happen in a scalable way. What we are seeing increasingly is payers are making that investment, because I do think they see the value of this, given the importance that behavioral has taken. And I don't want to speak for Virtus. Andrew, you could comment on this, but you are seeing traction with payers in approaching them with different models that actually are a little bit more innovative, particularly given the interesting composition of what I call clinical and subclinical services inside of Birches that you can actually put together into a compelling offering that ultimately gets the patient slash the member to the right care for the right amount of spend and gets them help. So I do think increasingly you see appetite for these things, particularly in these emerging areas where, as a payer, I really want to get ahead of that.
Andrew, any thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So about almost a year ago, right, Chris, I was on stage talking about where are the payers going with these models. And we finished that conversation saying, be patient, we're going to continue to push this forward. I think all of the payers are continuing to push this forward as fast as they can, considering the complexities. We are already engaged in a couple of different bundle type arrangements that are incredibly exciting. So through this year, we're going to find opportunities to show that total cost of care reduction, because it's not only just saying, hey, we're going to measure outcomes. It's about combining measurable outcomes with stabilization, which is the reduced aspect of care, right? So once we get people through the tough phase, finding ways to get them to stabilization, whether it's subclinical groups, all these different areas, that's where we can really work with these payers closely in a measurement-based outcome model that reduces utilization, but make sure that at the end of the day, the member's still getting the level of care that they don't suddenly spring back up to a place where they are in a bad situation. So I think we continue to move toward the right place. And now that I'm on the provider side, we're open to have any of those conversations, because it's wonderful to see more and more payers get excited about those kind of alternative reimbursement models.
And Yusuf, we're going to turn to you for the last word here. Any thoughts about payment innovation at the intersection of gambling treatment?
I would loop in, I think, the value of the employer, the value to the employer here. So, you know, in a world of sort of bundled performance-oriented payments, what I want as a patient is I want to get care really fast at no cost or a cost that I can afford. I want to be able to have a sort of a community and the ability to work maybe in a group setting with others who are dealing with this. And I want ongoing support digitally or otherwise, right? And so that, I think, is largely one of the models that Birches employs. On the employer side, if I, as an employee, can actually link the outcomes, the ability to access this care, the ability to manage my symptoms, the ability to get my life and my family and my marriage in order with my relationship to my employer and the ability to access care that way, I think that's a super powerful sort of win-win-win. And so as these innovative payment models emerge with payers and potentially with relationships with employers, I think there's tremendous, tremendous benefit that employers can see too.
Yusuf, Rebecca, Andrew, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Chris Larson, Associate Editor for Behavioral Health Business. We'll catch you next time.